to Your Right to Speak's discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode 5. I'm Sammy, your host. Today we'll be talking with a colleague and a friend, Josh. Josh is currently a social worker student at Ryerson. I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Josh. I know whenever we talk about social justice in a room, I always look forward to hearing what Josh's opinion is. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Josh, can you please introduce yourself?
So as Sammy said, my name is Josh, and I'm 21 years old, and I do go to Ryerson for their social work program. And as Sammy also said, I'm a colleague of his here at the Provincial Advocate's Office for Children and Youth. I live downtown Toronto, but I'm originally from Midland, Ontario, so a few hours north of here. And yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Thanks, Josh. So before we dive into the whole conversation, I was wondering if you can please explain to me what stigma is.
So I think the general definition of stigma is that society and individuals deem a specific characteristic as wrong or they devalue it. However, I think it's important to note that stigma, the way we talk about it right now and tends to be, and when we talk about it in academics, that it's an individual thing, and that I think we need to recognize that stigma actually comes out of a social context and it comes out of discrimination. So while people think that stigma is all about individual interactions and attitudes, stigma comes from a broader social framework where we say that we have policies and programs that discriminate against people and allow for stigma to exist.
So how would you prefer to be identified? Gay, black and gay, a person? And can you explain why you want to be identified that way?
I think I would want to be identified as Josh. but I think the reality is we have so many intersecting identities that there's many ways you can identify me. Like even my introduction, there's identities in there. In terms of, you know, race and sexuality, you know, black and gay is what I am, but these are self-identified labels. And I don't think anyone should ever come up to me in the street and say, oh, you must be black and gay. Like, for one, gay is self-identified, and two, there's no reason for someone to identify me as black unless it's a specific situation where that's needed.
So now we're going to get into the more interesting questions. Mm-hmm. So I've watched a few documentaries on the LGBT community as well as the black community. And in these documentaries, I've learned that there's a stigma of being black and gay. So do you find this to be true? And can you, if it is true, can you please explain what the stigma is for our listeners?
So I think it is. It's not that I think it is true. It is true that there is a stigma about blackness and gayness. And it comes from within the black community. It comes from within the gay community. It even comes from within the straight community on ideas of blackness and gayness. So, for example, you know, we tend to associate gayness with femininity in society for some reason. And so that is the complete opposite of how black men have been framed. Black men have been framed as aggressive, specifically sexually aggressive. And so you can't have feminine and sexually aggressive. Those are two different binaries. And so I think that because we hold these two ideas, we can't associate blackness with gayness. Now, is that to say that all gay men are feminine? No, but that's just the way society has viewed it. We've attached gender roles with sexual orientation. Now, I want to specifically talk about, you know, certain aspects of where this is coming from. So, for example, if you take Pride and you look at Pride, Pride is a very white space. And while people say, well, Pride is inclusive, it really isn't if you look at the marketing of it, if you look at who's attending, if you look at the type of the event. So marketing of it always features white men. And if it's not white men, they feature mixed race black men, so men who are closer to the color of whiteness. Or they depict black men, darker skinned black men, but they picture them in a way that fits the stereotype of them being sexually aggressive. Now, if you go further into that and you think about like who's attending these events, it's specifically white men. It's for a reason, because it's expensive to go to Pride. So Pride is no longer you walk into a venue and you have fun. And people are going to tell me, well, the 519 Center, all their events are free. Their events are free. However, you can pay to jump the line and get in. And there's a capacity, which means that, you know, white men are paying to get into these venues ahead of time, or to have the jump line, and that pushes out, you know, minority men who can't, or minority peoples who can't attend these events or afford to jump the line. And then, you know, if you even look at the cost of it, like, the costs are, like, I'm pretty sure the cost of, like, some of the events is, like, $150.
Really?
Right? And that's not the 519 events. Those are, like, the parties that go on for Pride. And so, again, if we look at the economic reality for black men, it's not that they're going to be able to afford $150. So there's many different ways that... that black men are pushed out. And even if you look at who's sponsoring these events, so Scotiabank, TD, banks are white spaces filled with white men. And so in that, you know, these white men get, you know, line bypasses from their work. They get into events for free. So these are people that are already taking capacity that, you know, black people, I'm just specifically speaking to experience of black people, but it applies to many people. But that pushes out black men from these events. But I also think it comes from the black community, right? Because, and I think there's a specific historical past to why the black community is very abrasive with homosexuality and gayness. And I think that's how men were treated, how black men were treated by, you know, white men in the slavery era. And I think, and Laverne Cox speaks to this related to trans identity, that the black community sees gayness and even trans identity as being emasculated and being castrated, as a lot of people identify as. And I think for black men, there's a historical context to why they think that. And that's because they were treated in such a way that nowadays it's been passed down generationally, that trauma, and that trauma is coming out in terms of being homophobic. But, you know, like I said, like, that's not to say that the black community is more homophobic, but that's where I think there's a historical context where their homophobia is coming from. And I think, you know, in terms of stigma and being black and gay, and I think it's learned, and it's very much learned through, you know, pornography. If you look at gay pornography, and I actually did an essay on this. If you look at gay pornography, it puts black men in certain roles. Those roles are always aggressive and sexually aggressive. And so then white men get to fetishize this, but they also learn that black men are aggressive and sexually aggressive. So the only times that A, that they're attracted to black men is if black men fit that stereotype, or B, the only time they want to interact with black men is in those spaces. Outside of those type of spaces, they will not want to interact with black men. And if you also look at, like, if you look at how they categorize white men get to exist in every category of porn, right? So they get to, like, you know, if you think about office porn and, you know, medical porn, these are types of porn that hold status. And so they always depict white men as having status. They always depict black men as lacking status. So again, they're attaching stigma. They're saying, well, blackness is an individual marker that does not deserve status in pornography. And, you know, and that happens in society as well, but that's a reflection of society and what their beliefs are. So I think, you know, in terms of stigma and how it's attached to black men's bodies, I think it's coming from so many communities in so many ways that, you know, the LGBT community interacts with black men, how the black community interacts with black men. And, you know, it can even come from black men themselves, right? So there's a lot of black men who say that they are not attracted to other black men because they've internalized this stigma, and they've internalized these ideas about blackness. And so they say, well, I will only be with a white man because, you know, for them and for some black men, they've internalized the status of whiteness. So in that, they won't interact with their own black peers. And so that, you know, that kind of disintegrates the black community and stops us from, you know, coming together as a collective and saying, you know, these things are wrong. These practices and these beliefs that you're showing are wrong. Well, you know, we can't do that right now because what's happening is, you know, the black gay community doesn't want to come together because we've internalized these ideas about ourselves.
There's a few things that I think we just need to clarify for the listeners. Mm-hmm. But before that, I think the pornography point is very interesting. I didn't look at it that way before, so good point. So you talked about 519. Can you please like explain what that agency or organization is.
So the 519 Community Center is a nonprofit organization located downtown Toronto on Church Street. And they offer a bunch of different resources and services and programs. And specifically during Pride, they offer, they host events that are meant to be free and you just donate what you can. And so as I was saying, like that's supposed to be accessible. And then what I was saying is, well, in reality, it's not accessible with how they actually operate it. So yeah, so that's the 519 Center. And I think they're a great center, but I think like how they host the events during Pride is a little bit, not fake, but they're not honest with what they're trying to do.
Another thing, if you can just please clarify for the listeners, is you use the term whiteness. Mm-hmm. So I know I had learned that my first year in my undergrad, and I didn't know that what that was before. So can you please explain?
So whiteness, oh God, we talk about this every year. So it's ingrained in my head. So whiteness is a few things. So it's essentially a system of privileging white skin, white people, and white perspectives, right? And so the reason why, and so some people say, well, isn't that all the same? No, because when I say white skin, as I said, mixed race black men are closer to white and whiteness. So there's a privileging of white skin. However, if you were to take that mixed race black man and compare them to just a white man, the white man is going to be more privileged in certain situations compared to the mixed race black man. So that's what I'm saying in terms of whiteness. And so then, you know, as I was saying, like, you know, pornography, you know, how events are run at Pride, all of it is maintaining a system of whiteness. It's maintaining a system of privileging white skin, white people, and white perspectives.
So it sounds like it's a multi-layered issue. Mm-hmm. And what I find interesting, and I had talked to a friend of mine who's also part of the LGBTQ community, mm-hmm. was that the community fights for inclusiveness mm-hmm. and equality and equity and all that, but within the community itself, there is inequality.
Oh, there's so many problems. There's misogyny, there's sexism, there's transphobia, there's biphobia. Like, there are, and I would say it comes from each of the communities, but I think specifically for white gay men, a lot of these systems of oppression, so these systems of like having power over someone, is coming from white gay men, because in terms of the LGBT community, they hold the highest status. White gay men are always put in media. White gay men are the ones running Pride. White gay men are the ones taking over roles that actually other people held. You know, for example, if you were to watch the Stonewall movie that was just released, you know, they thought, you know, the movie was centered around a black trans person. Well, they completely disintegrated that role and were like, no, we're going to put a white gay man, right? So that goes to show you the status that white gay men have in comparison to the rest of the LGBTQ community.
So, okay, another question is, one, how can we, as a society, fix these stigmas? And then, even more specific question, how do you think within the LGBT community, those stigmas can be, I guess, fixed? Like, how do we move? So there's a loaded question.
Let me pull out my pocket guide to how to fix everything. I think on a societal level, just like everyone in general, I think we need to stop thinking of identities as existing in silos. And by that, I mean like as existing separate. Our identities shape what we are, and they intersect. So I am not just black. I am not black and gay. I am actually a black gay man, right? Those intersect. My blackness has been shaped by my gayness, and my gayness has been shaped by my blackness. And then, you know, my gender as a man has been shaped by those two identities. And then my gender as a man has shaped those identities. So I think we need to realize that while we have these discussions on identities, you know, specifically, you know, white gay men. So it's kind of like, you know, feminism, how feminism started off, and it was mm-hmm. specifically, you know, just white women, middle class. And so that left out a lot of other women. So, you know, the gay and lesbian rights, so that's how they've literally framed it historically, is the lesbian and gay rights movement. Well, actually, there's a lot of other people that existed, but the lesbian and gay rights movement left out, you know, the racial categories, and that's because the people that were shown in the media were people that held status in comparison to the rest of the community. So I think as a society, we need to recognize that not only do we stereotype what a gay man is, we have a specific racial stereotype to what we believe a gay man is. So like I go into schools and do workshops with students on homophobia, and we also go into community centers. And so we talk about stereotypes of gay men, and at a certain age point, the classes will start to say white. So they know that the stereotypical gay man is white, because that's what's been shown them in the media. So on a societal level, we need to start putting more racialized individuals in these identities. You know, we need to actually use those people who are those identities to stop having actors play gay, because that's cute and everything. But, like, there are actually actors who are gay who can play that role because they are that role.
That's a very good
point. And not only that, but that's discrimination, right? You're excluding someone and you're appropriating their identity and you're benefiting from it. And that is a form of discrimination. But the media won't take that up. They'll say, well, you know, this person just didn't fit our idea of what this gay man would be. What are you saying about that? Like, what is your idea of a gay man? And I think if people start to unpack that and deconstruct what they hold as a gay man or as a black man, they'll realize that, you know, those thoughts are reproducing, you know, oppression related to sexual orientation, oppression related to racial identity. And so I think, again, as society goes forward, and if they really want to end these oppressions, they have to start thinking on a whole, how do these identities intersect, and then what ideas do we hold that maintain this form of oppression? In terms of the LGBTQ community, you know, for one, even as I say that, you know, I should have said asterisks. Like, there's so many people in this community who are excluded because we just don't want to say the full thing. Like, you know, so really it should be 2S, because, you know, Indigenous peoples were here first. So it should be 2S LGBT. So even then, you're already seeing that the LGBT community is reproducing colonialism, because we're putting Indigenous people last. Well, that's not how it should be. They should be first, because they were here first. And, you know, I think it's time that this community starts to discuss with one another. I think what's happened is it's kind of like we've formed communities as L, and we form communities as 2S, and we form communities as G, and we form communities as B, and form communities as T, and then that's where we're staying. And people are struggling with coming together and discussing because there's some uncomfortability, because, you know, when there's uncomfortability because we hold notions and preconceived ideas about each other, and we're not willing to be confronted and having to deconstruct that. And, you know, a lot of my white gay friends can't. Like, I have tried having discussions with them and they just don't get it. So when they say, you know, words that are transphobic, they're like, well, I don't get that. And I'm like, well, I don't understand how you don't get that, because you have had words as a gay man used against you, and I'm telling you that you can't say these things. Well, no. And so it's very easy to see that because white gay men are a minority group, I think that they believe that they can't reproduce oppression. They're like, well, I've been oppressed, therefore I can't oppress. And it's like, well, that's not how that works. And in fact, even those who are oppressed can reproduce the same oppression that is oppressing them. So gay men can very much engage in homophobia as being an out gay man. So I think, you know, the 2S LGBTQQ, what else is there? A.
Yeah, it's quite long.
Yeah, see? But that just goes to show you how diverse the community is. And we need to start having these discussions. We need to stop operating in silos. We need to start talking with one another. We need to start not just talking to one another, but, like, being around one another and engaging with one another. Because, you know, I think that will help. Because then we'll probably start to talk. And included in that is we need to have discussions on race. You know, we can't ignore race, because race is very much operating in a very covert way in this community, and no one wants to talk about it. no one gets it. Like, I've had the same discussion on gay pornography with my boyfriend and, you know, our friend, and they didn't get it. They're like, well, I don't think that's not right. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, I've seen one black man in the office porn category. I'm like, oh, good, we have one, right? So, but they don't get that. Like, they don't get that that's tokenizing and that's there for a specific reason. So that way they can be like, no, we have one, right? And so I think there's so many ideas that the gay community and that the, you know, every other community needs to unpack. And I think that needs to happen soon, or we're going to end up having the group's going to become more disintegrated, and people aren't going to want to engage with one another.
It sounds like it's like a movement within a movement, mm-hmm. right? Or it's like the community communicating with mm-hmm. each other. With it's like multi-layered.
Well, exactly. And even in my entire discussion, like, what about the disability community, mm-hmm. right? Like, the disability community has been completely ignored by this movement. And why? Because we hold notions about disability and, you know, how disability is put in media. We hold those notions. So this community won't even discuss. And, you know, I've read stories where disabled people try to come into gay bars and they get turned down because purely based on their disability. Well, that's not okay. That's discrimination. But we lack those discussions. So this community has, I think at some point, some movement needs to sit down, think about it, and be like, what other identities are we excluding? Mm-hmm. Who is not at this table and who needs to be at this table for us to actually be inclusive? Because right now, the 2S LGBTQ QA movement is not inclusive. It's very exclusive. It is white, and it's able-bodied, right? And it's specifically a middle class type of movement. I wouldn't say so much maybe for the trans community, but that's maybe because of the amount of transphobia that is in our society. But for the rest of the movement, I would say there's that is very much operating and has excluded many people.
Thank you for that. No, that was really great. It sounds like, I think it happens with other types of like social justice mm-hmm. movements that they start off in one community.
Yeah.
And it just sticks with that one community.
And then they kind of we forgot these people. It's just like, you can't do that. You can't forget them. Because when you forget people, you're reproducing an oppression. You're excluding someone, intended or not. The result is someone is excluded.
Well, maybe you'll be the one to bring the whole community together.
I'm trying. Right? Everyone love each other.
Did you hear that, listeners? I have two more questions for you. And this is more for the social work side of you and the CYW side of me, child and youth worker side. Mm-hmm. How do you think people who work with children and youth can support, I don't even want necessarily black youth, but can support youth that are, I guess, just coming into their own within the LGBT community, Q, and all of the abbreviations.
Well, and I'm going to intersect blackness there because it's part of our discussion. I think first, if you're working with children and youth, you need to really think about why the heck we don't have conversations about sex and sexuality with children and youth until we absolutely have to. That's not okay. We have viewed, and this isn't to oppress asexuality. It's a real identity, and people are that identity, and there's no reason why we should use it as a label. But we view, for some reason, children and youth as asexual. When they start to show sexuality, we try to staunch it and say, that's not okay. Well, no, the reality is, it's actually not okay for us to stop and mitigate their sexuality. Can we provide them with information to keep them safe? Yes. Should we have discussions with them in a non-biased way? Yes. So what tends to happen is when, you know, children and youth start to display sexuality, we assume that they're straight. Okay? No. If you actually look at it statistically, most people, their first sexual interaction is with the same sex. It's not with the opposite sex. Am I saying that, you know, that whole interaction was as our thoughts of sex being, you know, penetrative? No, but it's a sexual engagement. And the reality is we don't have discussions about gayness. We don't have discussions about bisexuality. We don't have discussions about asexuality because, you know, people can still be attracted to one another and not have a sexual attraction. So I think if you're working with children and youth, you have to keep an open mind and not be afraid to have these discussions. You're not, when you provide someone with information, they're not going to instantly go out and then go use it. Like, hey, I did, you know, 10 years of math in primary and secondary school. I still use a calculator when I'm doing groceries, right? So therefore, you gave me information. I very much choose not to use it. And, you know, I think if we stop seeing children and youth as either asexual, or heterosexual, we'll really start to have to think about who are children and youth. Like, what is going on? And if you think about specifically in this day and age, the access that children and youth have to sex and sexual material is profound. And the issue is earlier generations don't know how to access all that information. They don't know what children and youth are learning. So again, even while you're working with children and youth, you need to stay updated, right? Because if a child and youth comes up to you and says, you know, what does pansexual mean? And you're just like, I don't know, is that even a real thing? Like, you've already put down an identity. And I know that's a lot on a person, like, to say, well, you need to know all these identities, but how can we have to instantly know what straight is, yeah, right? So there is no reason why you can't know what all these other identities are. And I think specifically for Black youth. So Black youth are definitely funneled into the heterosexual assumption. There's very little, there's a lot of struggle with, I would say, workers to really think about Black youth as, you know, LGBTQ. And I think those types of notions need to be deconstructed, because I would say there are a lot of Black people living in this world and they're not being who they want to be because they didn't have access to someone who could support them. They didn't have, and, you know, specifically, you know, if we're talking about people, Black youth coming in contact with workers, they're probably coming in contact with workers through the foster care system or through group home care. And in that care, they were never introduced or supported by an LGBTQ person. And so I think it's harder for the Black community than identify with it, because then you can say, well, but they have access to media. But like I said, this media is white. Mm-hmm. So when all this media shows Black people as straight, then that doesn't work. And the only time they show Black people is when in the community is when they're a trans person, and that's because they've done specifically in specific roles. So, you know, the Black trans person, Laverne Cox, they're in jail. Like, hello. Are you kidding me? Like, that is reproducing oppression. You were showing a Black person in jail. You couldn't show that Black person as a judge. You couldn't show that Black trans person as a lawyer. No, we had to show them as someone in jail. So I think the reality is workers have to think about what children and youth are watching, what children and youth are able to access, and what children and youth are actually saying. So a lot of times, children and youth will bring up, they'll say something that kind of indicates that they are other than straight. And I think what tends to happen is workers don't know how to deal with that. So then they just kind of try to put them back in the straight role, or they try to put them back in the asexual role so as they don't have to deal with it. And I'm saying you do have to, you know, and I don't even want to say deal with it, because that's rude. You know, you need to address it and support this person.
I think that's great advice. So I have one more question for you, and I ask this of all my guests because it's a constant learning thing for me, and it's also very individualized in my opinion. Mm-hmm. What does advocacy mean to you?
I think something I've learned is advocacy takes like many different forms, and that's like it's kind of like you said, it's very individual. So for me, advocacy could just be in a discussion with a friend. If they say something that's not exactly correct or something that reproduces oppression, advocacy is trying to reframe that for that person. And we might not see that as advocacy, but it is. It's resisting certain assumptions and notions. I think advocacy is also when you're out and about and you hear someone saying something that's, again, incorrect or, like, quite oppressive, advocacy is still resisting those notions. And, you know, I would never tell someone to put themselves in an unsafe space. But the reality is I don't think we can always tell when something is safe and unsafe. And so sometimes you might have to take that risk. But I think that's hard because then you lose your you're no longer anonymous. You've made yourself known to that person that might be saying something wrong. But that's advocacy. And I think, again, advocacy is also coming together as a collective, whether you identify in these groups or not, coming together and thinking about, you know, how can we deconstruct assumptions that we hold in society and in these advocacy groups. How can we be more inclusive of other voices and perspectives? How can we facilitate these other voices and perspectives to allow them to be their own voices and perspectives? And then advocacy, I think, is also like, who can we go to come together with us and to go forward to break down, you know, as we said, like stigma, but, you know, more so discrimination and prejudice and all this stuff. all this good stuff. But yeah, I think that's what advocacy for me is. It's multifaceted. I don't think, and like, because like some people think, and not think, but some people do advocacy just online. Like they are like through Facebook and through social media. That's their form of advocacy, and that is legitimate advocacy. So I think it's hard to say because, like, what advocacy for me right now as a student might be very different than what advocacy for me as a hopefully fully employed social worker is. So I think, yeah, and I think we have to be aware that our definition of advocacy might not be the same as other people's form of advocacy, and we have to allow space for that because, you know, one example is like reclaimed language. A lot of people don't see that as advocacy, especially within the Black community. But it is because, you know, reclaimed language has specific meaning and is a specific form of resistance. And I think we need to allow space like reclaimed language to exist and for people to use that as their form of advocacy.
I think it's a great definition that you've used, so I have nothing to add to that. before we end off, do you have anything else to say for our listeners?
I think I've talked enough. No, I think that's basically it. I think I do want to, like, again, bring it back to the point of how people view stigma. I think we need to really think about stigma and really ground and plant stigma in a social context that's created, because people always talk about stigma as an individual interaction, and it's not. Stigma comes out of systemic and institutional oppression that has allowed stigma to exist. It is not something, it's not me going up to someone and being rude. It is someone creating a space where I can do that. That is stigma. And I think I just want to make that clear and how people use stigma going forward.
I think that's a great way to end off. So thank you again, Josh, for your time today. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. If you are a child or youth and would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of a topic that we should be talking about, please email me at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That is yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.